In the Old Testament, in the second book of Samuel, the 17th chapter and the 17th verse. We begin to read in the midst of the chapter in which Absalom is planning to go after his father and indeed kill him. And two messengers are sent out from Jerusalem to tell David, who is in flight on his way to cross the River Jordan, what has been planned. There they are, sons of the priests. 2 Samuel 17:17. Jonathan and Ahimaaz were staying at En-Rogel, which is just under Jerusalem. A servant girl was to go and inform them, and they were to go and tell King David, for they could not risk being seen entering the city. But a young man saw them and told Absalom. So the two of them left quickly and went to the house of a man in Bahurim. He had a well in his courtyard, and they climbed down into it. His wife took a covering and spread it out over the opening of the well and scattered grain over it. No one knew anything about it. When Absalom's men came to the woman at the house, they asked, "Where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan?" The woman answered them, "They crossed over the brook." The men searched but found no one, so they gave up and returned to Jerusalem. After the men had gone, the two climbed out of the well and went to inform King David. They said to him, "Set out and cross the river at once. Ahithophel has advised such and such against you." So David and all the people with him set out and crossed the Jordan. By daybreak, no one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. When Ahithophel saw that his advice had not been followed, he saddled his donkey and set out for his house in his hometown. He put his house in order and then hanged himself. So he died and was buried in his father's tomb. David went north after crossing the Jordan to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Absalom had appointed Amasa over the army in place of Joab. They were cousins. Amasa was the son of a man named Jether, an Israelite who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nahash and sister of Zeruiah, the mother of Joab. The Israelites and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi, son of Nahash from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir, son of Amiel from Lo-debar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite from Rogelim, brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery. Well, of course, they were camping out. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted corn, beans and lentils, honey, curds and sheep, and cheese from cow's milk for David and his people to eat. For they said, "The people have become hungry and tired and thirsty in the desert." David mustered the men who were with him and appointed over them. This is a strange thing. It doesn't say that all these soldiers, not only people with comforts for David and his people, but a great many soldiers, thousands of them, had gathered to him across the Jordan. It says nothing about that, simply the implication that they did it. David mustered the men who were with him and appointed over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. David sent the troops out, a third under the command of Joab, a third under Joab's brother Abishai, son of Zeruiah, and a third under the foreigner Ittai the Gittite. The king told the troops, "I myself will surely march out with you." But the men said, "You must not go out. If we are forced to flee, they won't care about us. Even if half of us die, they won't care. But you are worth 10,000 of us. It would be better now for you to give us support from the city of Mahanaim." The king answered, "Unlike him, I will do whatever seems best to you." So the king stood beside the gate while all the men marched out in units of hundreds and thousands. The king commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai. Notice this very particularly in view of what happened. "Be gentle with the young man Absalom for my sake." And all the troops heard the king giving orders concerning Absalom to each of the commanders. The army marched into the field to fight Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim, which, despite its name, was across Jordan, Trans-Jordan. There, did you ever hear of a battle taking place in a forest? You see what that means? There the army of Israel was defeated by David's men, and the casualties that day were great, 20,000 men. The battle spread out over the whole countryside, and notice, the forest claimed more lives that day than the sword. Now, Absalom happened to meet David's men. I like the word happened. God is in heaven, you know. He was riding his mule, and as the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, Absalom's head got caught in the tree. He was left hanging in midair, while the mule he was riding kept on going. When one of the men saw this, he told Joab, "I have just seen Absalom hanging in an oak tree." Joab said to the man who had told him this, "What? You saw him? Why didn't you strike him to the ground right there? Then I would have to give you 10 shekels of silver and a warrior's belt." But the man replied, "Even if 1,000 shekels were weighed out into my hands, I would not lift my hand against the king's son. In our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, protect the young man Absalom for my sake. And if I had put my life in jeopardy, and nothing is hidden from the king, you would have kept your distance from me," meaning he wouldn't have supported him. Joab said, "I'm not going to wait like this for you." So he took 3 javelins in his hand and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still alive in the oak tree. And 10 of Joab's armor bearers surrounded Absalom, struck him, and killed him. Then Joab sounded the trumpet, and the troops stopped pursuing Israel, for Joab halted them. They took Absalom, threw him into a big pit in the forest and piled up a large heap of rocks over him. Meanwhile, all the Israelites fled to their homes. During his lifetime, Absalom had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley just under Jerusalem as a monument to himself. For he thought, I have no son, although he had actually, to carry on the memory of my name. He named the pillar after himself, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. Amen. May God bless. The Old Testament, the second book of Samuel, chapter 17 and chapter 18 to the 18th verse. David is in flight from his son Absalom, who has unseated his father from his throne. Ahithophel, his treacherous counselor, has given Absalom rash advice to pursue his father through the wilderness of Judea and presumably intercept him before he is able to cross Jordan. Hushai's advice, David's friend, since he was sent back to Jerusalem to spy for David, his advice was to take time to muster the tribes of Israel and so overwhelm David's ragged supporters. But Hushai's intention was simply to delay the pursuit, to let David get safely away. And Absalom, who at first accepted Ahithophel's advice, subsequently thought Hushai's advice was better. And unknown to Absalom, that advice would be conveyed to David to hurry across the Jordan as quickly as possible and get well away before Absalom's army of the tribes arrived. In our first verses, starting from 17:17, we read that Hushai's advice to David had been smuggled out of Jerusalem, but someone saw the priestly messengers and told Absalom. So they were followed and had to hide in a house by the way, so that Absalom's men couldn't find them. And they got well away to David. So by daybreak, all David's company had crossed the river. We next hear of David at Mahanaim. That's well up the Transjordan territory, the other side of the Jordan, where you may remember the angels of God met Jacob before Peniel and before he faced Esau. And Mahanaim was also the border between Gad, the territory of Gad and Manasseh on the far side of Jordan. It was also the place, you remember, where Saul's surviving son, Ishbosheth, chose to stand there and proclaim himself king of Israel in place of his dead father Saul. But he was murdered, you remember. It is at this point in the narrative that the writer includes the sad news about treacherous Ahithophel. He was so depressed by Absalom refusing his advice in favor of Hushai's that assuming that his career was ended, he went home, put his house in order, and hanged himself. He was probably right in his surmise that his career was finished, for Absalom's own life was almost at an end, too, if he had known it. Ahithophel did a Hitler, didn't he? There are those, you know, who, unless they are top dog, think they are better dead. What a destructive thing personal ambition can be. You get near the top of the tree, and consumed with vaulting desire for even greater self-glory and achievement, where there is no higher to rise, the only thing you can do, if you're near the top of the tree, is to jump into the fair air and end it all. And it reminds us of Jesus' words, "He who finds his life will lose it, but he who loses his life for my sake shall find it." Now, strangely enough, as I pointed out during the reading, there's no hint of an army mustering to David at that comparatively remote place, Mahanaim. It's an assumption that we must make in view of the army which did appear. Where they came from, we don't know. But we read more about the abundant comforts that the people brought to David and his company than about the army which came to his aid. But they came in their hundreds and thousands. So David, like himself, proceeded, as a great military commander which he was, he proceeded to organize his army, dividing them into three, one part led by his nephew Joab, another by his brother Abishai, and a third by Ittai the Gittite. David planned to lead them out to battle himself, old man though he was, which is perhaps natural for him. But the men said, "Oh no, no, you're the one the enemy wants to kill you. You keep in the background." And so David, who has been learning a lesson or two in his humiliation, that he was not the whole cheese, and that other people had good ideas as well as he, and sometimes better. So David submits to the men and stays in the city. He's a wise leader, you see, who takes advice from knowledgeable people in other fields than his own. And perhaps sometimes in his own field, we never know everything, and should always be ready and willing to accept advice even from unusual directions, and even sometimes from hostile quarters. So, as the army marched out to battle in their hundreds and thousands, doubtless with their commander's instructions ringing in their ears, David began to realize that they were going out against his Absalom, traitor to his father though he was. And David's heart melted within him. "Be gentle with the young man Absalom," he said to the soldiers as they went out. "But surely, surely, David, you knew how futile that was to warn these men about that. They were too loyal to you, to their soldier King David, to heed that kind of advice. But perhaps David expected the like of Joab, his nephew, whose military skill he obviously admired and trusted. He would have expected him to heed his uncle's plea to be gentle with Absalom. But after all, you see, it was Joab who engineered Absalom's return to Jerusalem. You remember when the king was too offended with his favorite son to have anything to do with him. One wonders how many snorted at David's plea to be gentle with Absalom. For if David wasn't incensed at what his mountebank son had done to him, his men were angry enough at him. But they would have, of course, have kept these thoughts to themselves. But nonetheless, they were angry. But then, Wouldn't Joab be kind to Absalom if he was caught? Well, we shall see. But here again, we see the soft, tender side of David. Although, admittedly now, it becomes less admirable and even more sick and sentimental than formerly. For you see, the spoilt child, Absalom, had gained ascendancy. And there is less sign of David being cured of his fatal addiction to Absalom than ever. His mind is nothing less than warped in his pathetic love for that wicked son. So we begin to see that this rebellious creature, Absalom, has to be liquidated, even if it's just to bring David to his senses. Has to happen. You know, when they talk, as they do so much, about love, 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 so often, as outcomes show, what is often thought of as love is something very different from real love. It is often very sick and wayward, as it is often highly unpredictable, even dangerous and deadly, what they call love. That is sick and wrong and wicked. Handsome is as handsome does, is a good word. That's what we were saying about those affected by the Toronto blessing. If it changes lives and makes men more godly, we must own it, even if we are put off by the antics. And so we might be inclined to say, can't we have revival and the Lord's extraordinary blessing without losing our heads and going off into faints and trances and falling backwards and laughing like to kill ourselves and emitting cries like animals? Where there is a genuine work of the Spirit, but odd things take place, I believe the Lord is very, very patient and long-suffering. But I also believe he is constantly saying to those who lead such movements, careful you, careful, don't let the enemy creep in. He is subtler than you think. For you see, there are some people who are not really fit for leadership at such a time, because they are not penetrating enough in their spiritual intelligence to see where danger lurks and lies in a fellowship and where it doesn't. You see, David is still a somewhat sick man. And apparently it's going to take nothing less than Absalom's death to shake him out of his fantasy and come to his senses. Wait and see. So, Off went his army to the battle, with David's words ringing in their ears, "Watch my son." It wasn't a very stirring word to send his warriors out to the battle with, was it? I wonder if they simply ignored what the old man said. Joab, what did you think of what David said about Absalom? It was you who encouraged David to bring Absalom back to Jerusalem. What do you think now? You're about to go into battle against Absalom. Have you changed your mind? How does it feel, Job? What are you thinking? Well, we don't know what he felt, but we certainly know what he did, and how peculiar the circumstances were that led to what he did. Who would have believed it? Think earlier in the history of the liquidation of Saul and Abner and Ishbosheth, pretender to Saul's throne. And now, this upstart king liquidated. God knows how to get rid of unwanted men. Does that sound hard? Listen. He knows how to get rid of unwanted men. He doesn't need to lift a finger. For the free will of sinful man, that we were speaking of most pertinently on Wednesday, with all its quirks, the free will of sinful man will do it. Just wait and see. You don't need to lift a finger against your enemy if you are on God's side. The battle is not yours. It's the Lord's. You remember what the Lord said to Jehoshaphat by the prophet? He said to him, "You will not have to fight this battle. Take up your positions, stand firm, and see the deliverance that the Lord will give you." And you see, that was one of the most singular routs in the whole of the Old Testament. You remember? It was priests singing praises, which was the vanguard of that attack. As the army marched out to battle against the combined might of Ammon and Edom. And as they began to sing, the priests began to sing and praise at the front of the army. The Lord, it says, set ambushes against the men of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, who were invading Judah. And they were defeated. And this is how. The men of Ammon and Moab rose up against the men from Mount Seir to destroy and annihilate them. After they finished slaughtering the men of Seir, they helped to destroy one another. And when the men of Judah came to the place that overlooks the desert, and looked toward the vast army, all that they saw was dead bodies lying on the ground. No one escaped, says the word. You see, God doesn't need to lift a finger. Evil shall slay the wicked, says the word. And that's right, and we've got to wait. We've often got to wait a long time before evil slays the wicked. But it will. Very often we interfere, and that's bad. We don't allow God to rule his universe the way he wants. You see, God is so original in his permissions as well as in his own deeds to allow people. Oh, are you listening to this? God is so original in his permissions as well as in his own deeds, to allow people to do their own thing and to discover that when men do their own wicked thing, they fall so fantastically into God's barrow or basket that in heaven God must often be more than intrigued to see what his enemies are doing to further the Almighty's cause. Have you got that? Don't know what that noise was, but it's very distracting, and I must go over that again, because this is very important. If you don't get this, you miss something very valuable. God is so original in his permissions, as well as in his own deeds, to allow people to do their own thing, and so to fall fantastically into God's barrow, so that in heaven God must often be more than intrigued to see what his enemies are doing to further the Almighty's cause. And this must make the Almighty laugh louder than all his enemies. Go ahead, he says, and do your own thing, and come a cropper. You see, David determined that the battle should be joined in the forest of Ephraim, which, despite the name Ephraim, was obviously on the yonder side of Jordan. But who ever heard of waging war in a forest? But you see what happened. The battle spread out over the whole countryside, and the forest claimed more lives. The authorized version says, devoured more lives than the sword. Well, there could be no concerted attack in a forest, could there? Because of the trees, it would be every man for himself, as he steered himself between the trees. And that's what Absalom was doing when he rode too near a large oak and got himself fixed by the neck in its branches, so that his mount rode on and left the poor fellow hanging. Did you ever hear the like? But that's not all. A man saw this and told Joab. Why didn't you kill him then? Said Joab. I would have rewarded you handsomely for the deed. But, says the man, no reward would have induced me to kill the king's son. If I had, you would not have supported me, would you? Ah, you see, this man, ordinary soldier though he may have been, knew the treacherous nature of Joab, great commander though he was. You remember, it was Joab who killed Abner, Saul's commander, to David's great grief. For David knew a man when he saw one, and he admired Abner tremendously, and was heartbroken that Joab had slain him. But Joab wasted no time here. 3 javelins he thrust into Absalom's heart as he hung there, still alive, in the tree. And Joab's men finished the young man off, threw his body into a pit, and covered it over with a heap of stones. A very different burial from Absalom had planned for himself when he set up the memorial in the King's Valley under Jerusalem. And that's the end. That's the end of both Ahithophel and Absalom. I don't think, you know, that we can take more than that today. I'm thinking of the deep doctrines of predestination and free will that we have been addressing these Wednesdays in the confession. If ever there were examples of how God governs the universe, here it is again. This is very, very important. If ever there were examples of how God governs the universe by letting men do their own thing, we have it here. What a lesson. What a lesson. What wisdom for Christians to see how God lets wicked men do their own thing to their own destruction. Wickedness shall slay, evil shall slay the wicked. You see, as I hinted earlier, we are such interferers. We long to help God with his strategies, but we don't always know his strategies. He needs, in that sense, he needs no help from us. He knows what he is doing, and he knows what his enemy is doing, and what he will do in response. That's why we have intelligence about Christ's cross from the third chapter of Genesis. You see, hints about what God will do. So, from his throne, far removed from temporal interference, the Almighty watches as the laws, the inevitable laws of his universe unfold, which are together, are all together on the side of his righteousness and his holiness, and therefore work for good to them that love God, and work for the fulfillment of God's holy purposes. And the more his enemies oppose him, the better results he gains. Who could imagine a greater victory than that of Calvary? The darkest of the night was just before that wonderful, totally unexpected dawn of the resurrection, because God waits his time for his victories. And when they are accomplished, he can honestly say, so very often, well, I had nothing to do with that. Absalom's death, for instance. The Almighty could honestly say, I left it to my enemies to do my will. And evil men did it perfectly. Isn't that exciting? Doubtless, in due course, much to his enemies' chagrin and dismay. It's marvelous, the control that God has, so that he holds his hand and lets evil destroy itself. Isn't that exciting? It makes me so excited, I can scarcely contain it. So marvelous. What a comfort. Why did Judas hang himself? Because he knew he was defeated by Jesus letting him have his own way. Jesus could have stopped him, possibly at an earlier stage in their association. He didn't. He let Judas do his own thing. And it ended in his suicide, as it often does, as we see here today. Hitler. What of the boys with the stolen car which killed the 18-year-old single mother in St. Macher Drive? What of that? It's happening every day. Poor Shirley Fraser to have to take that funeral service. But you see, God working his will out by letting people have their own willful, wicked way. Do you see that? It's frightening. And you see, the lessons it thrusts into our faces, if we are wise enough to have any idea of our sovereign Lord's method of governance of his own universe, is wonderful. I tell you, apart altogether from the blessings God gives his children, it is better to keep in with him and be on his side than be in any other state or position. What of that unhappy prince of our realm? Don't you think that as the revelations come thick and fast of life behind the scenes, he deeply regrets attempts to live two lives, one as the heir to the throne, and another in a tangled marital mess, because he didn't follow the life that John Stott would have mapped out for him when it is said he prepared him for confirmation. When Charles lay in the nursing home in Aberdeen, I think it was during or near the time of the typhoid alarm, after being retrieved from Balmoral, you remember, with pneumonia as a young lad, he asked the nurse what was the book on the mantelpiece, and she said it was the Bible. Oh, he said, as so it is reported by a nurse of ours who was in the nursing home at that time, give it me. I read a chapter of that every day. This is the book which teaches us how to live. Dan Smith, Margaret Trimble's lawyer, who was with us these last two weekends from America, was deeply impressed with Debbie Brown last Sunday evening and told me how much he admired her. And I simply said to Dan, that's what this book produces. I've known the girl intimately since she lived on my street. And used to ring my bell as a little girl, and we talked. Then she came to church with her aunt. If ever anyone absorbed what they read in the Bible, Debbie did. I'm thinking of a line from a hymn of my youth. 'Twill save you from 10,000 snares to mind religion young. You got that? 'Twill save you from 10,000 snares to mind religion young. And that's about it, isn't it? Poor David. Poor Absalom. But not poor you or me, if we walk with the Lord who governs the universe. And although he lets wayward people go their own way, he vastly prefers us to go his way, which is always, always the best.